All right, this is Psychedelic Frontier here with Rack Razam, the producer and writer of Aya Awakenings, based on his book of the same name. We're interviewing in the cinema where it's screening here tonight in Boston. Say hello, Rack.
Hello, Rack.
All right.
Hello, listeners.
So our first question for you is, it seems that you work at the crossroads of several disciplines. So how do you see yourself as an ethnobotanist in the tradition of Richard Evans Schultes, a psychonaut, an orator like Terrence McKenna or Alan Watts, a filmmaker, a Hunter S. Thompson-style journalist, or some new breed of human?
You know, that's such a beautiful introductory line that I might steal all of that, and I might just mash that up all together and give it a shake and call it Rack Razam. Look, Schultes and people like him of his generation in the field, you know, of ethnobotany and mapping the territory on the ground, both with the indigenous cultures and with the plants themselves. I mean, he was legendary, and rightly so, you know, for many decades there, all through the 40s and into the 50s and on, he really mapped the territory and was so invaluable in service to, you know, mapping the plants and bringing them back into the Western skill base. Terrence, of course, is so fondly remembered. You just have to say Terrence. You don't even have to say McKenna, really. Here's my theory on McKenna. McKenna, and it's quite funny because, you know, in my late teens, early 20s, you know, I read Terrence for the first time and just devoured his intellectual prowess and his mapping of hyperspace and his memes. His memes are actually viral. They've gone viral, and he has so much content that survives his physical form on the internet. I believe Terrence has become a distributed consciousness. And actually, I'll just do a little bit of a plug here. In 2012, I was helping facilitate this thing called iTerrence, and it's sort of like the digital Terrence McKenna project. There's an online website called LifeNaught, something like that, and they sort of build avatars, and the more content there is to build avatars, the more they learn and grow, and you have that interface. And Terrence is such an ideal archetype for that, because there's thousands of hours of his recordings of his his thoughts and his philosophy, and they can aggregate a lot of meaning. So I've run this by Dennis McKenna, and I've spoken to the family about this, and it's out there. You could do a search for iTerrence, the digital McKenna Terrence project, the DMT project, but I believe that Terrence has survived in distributed consciousness form, and his ideas that influenced me in my 20s were so fundamental that basically I feel like he carved out the paradigm, and his language has influenced a whole generation or two now of psychonautical explorers. And even if we don't realize it, you know, if we riff off our own inklings and our own appreciations of the zones we go into, we're still basically riffing off the territory that McKenna, you know, first sketched out. And language is so important, especially in these translinguistic type of realms, that even the language that he carved out is still the building blocks, I think, that I use in a lot of my work today. So, you know, both Schultes and McKenna and the whole gonzo sort of aspect with writers and reporters and journalists like Hunter S. Thompson or Tom Wolfe, I draw my lineage from. And when I wrote the book, Aya Awakenings, and I went to Peru and had the experiences, I was very much in that gonzo journalist zone of really documenting the experiences and really participating in the experiences, and then drawing upon that reservoir of language and knowledge that McKenna and others had contributed to try and encapsulate the experiences in the book, which became the film.
Wow. It's interesting that you say distributed consciousness, because it's been said that as long as we live in someone's memory, we're still alive in some sense, because we're still affecting people.
Yeah.
And for a long time, you know, we've had vehicles like books, for instance, Voltaire, to the extent that he's still affecting people, that people are living their lives in a touch different way than they might have if they hadn't read Voltaire. He's still alive in that sense, and because he's still affecting people. But now, with the advent of YouTube and everything else going on in the internet and Twitter and this instantaneous global exchange, you know, people have even more, I think, potential to live on. And it's not just an analogy. I think there is really something to the fact that there's a distributed network, a distributed consciousness that can exist in lots of other vehicles, living vehicles, after someone's death.
Totally. Well, you know, you have memes, and then you have clusters of memes called memeplexes. And memeplexes are sort of those nodal points where aggregation of ideas come together to form an ism, you know. And McKenna has really really anchored the psychedelic ism and the tryptamine experience, and he helped popularize the ayahuasca experience all through the 80s and 90s. And he really laid the groundwork for so much of that. And yeah, you're right. Like, some indigenous cultures, you know, believe in, where I'm from in Australia, with indigenous Australian Aborigines, they believe that, you know, it's not good to represent someone after they're dead, to not take photos of them or not to have them archived in any media, that something of the soul remains in the media itself. Mm-hmm. And if you can see them, it, you know, to look at this from a shamanic perspective, I remember William Burroughs talked about this quite a bit, and he's, you know, considered the godfather of DMT. But when he was doing a lot of experiments with cut up and with the power of language and of you know, mashing up language and playing around with it to get different energetic outputs or different responses, he was playing with this idea that, you know, you've got recordings of people, and if you've got recordings from people and their voice is there, it's a vibration, and the vibration is an energy. And if you're playing that vibration, say you play a record from the 1920s, the energy of that zeitgeist is then brought into the vibrational matrix of 21st century. And, you know, it's a bit like the weather, I guess. There's all these overlapping frequencies and, you know, meme fronts coming in, and you know, older style energies coming in, and it's this kaleidoscope matrix sort of mashup of vibration which anchors the energy. And, you know, linear time is a bit of an illusion, but there's something in the tribal people's appreciation of having a clean canvas, I guess, for having the baggage of the past coming in through these recordings. But in Terence's case, I think it magnetizes, and it's like an anchor in linear time for something which is beyond linear time. So his memeplexes and his clusters of ideas help really anchor the psychedelic experience and the entheogenic experience in a way that have really laid the bedrock for this generation of explorers.
All right. So I understand Aya Awakenings covers 5-MeO-DMT, which is not familiar to very many people, even psychonauts. So how would you describe the effects of 5-MeO-DMT to someone who has never tried it but has familiarity with, say, LSD or maybe even DMT?
Well, it's funny because the 5-MeO-DMT sequence in the film is definitely the energetic climax of the piece. But, you know, the film starts off talking about ayahuasca. I mean, it's basically the narration is taken directly from the book, which gives the emotional journey. It's something that, you know, maps my journey down to Peru in 2006 and my experiences with the shamans or the curanderos of the Amazon, and also to a larger degree why Westerners were going down there, and this generational snapshot of Western seekers going down to the ayahuasca lodges and drinking with the curanderos, both for personal healing and also for some type of spiritual reconnection to the larger web of life and the astral sort of dimensions. And as I went down, the book's like 500 pages, like 30 chapters, and there's two DMT chapters in there. And I was just lucky enough in 2006 that the flow of events, one of the Western curanderos, the Western shamans, he's known as the Gringo Shaman of Iquitos, Ron Wheelock, who's a very lovely guy. He's in his 50s, and he's been training and practicing as a shaman down there for about over 10 years now. He learned with the indigenous curanderos, and he definitely has it down pat. He has the right integrity, the right respect, the icaros, the magical songs, and very good abilities with healing and with helping the patients. But because he's a Westerner, he also didn't have the cultural dogma, because smokable 5 or smokable DMT in general is something that area of the Amazon wasn't familiar with. Now, DMT is used throughout South America by different tribes. There's been there's been examples of tribes that have the DMT snuffs, and they do the long hollow reed pipes, and one person will blow it into the other person's nose. They get an incredible mucus sort of, you know, drizzle that comes out, and they get the full, you know, DMT experience, the rocket to hyperspace type of thing. So DMT is well known by some tribes in the Amazon and is still in use to this day, and it's no less a sacrament than ayahuasca. It's just that there's been this synergy between the Western desire for reconnection and lineage of the indigenous curanderos, and a power plant like ayahuasca is the catalyst, and this romanticism around the quasi-religious nature of the vine and madre and the mother and the feminine energy of it and the healing of it that has catapulted ayahuasca to prominence. But other tribes, you know, throughout the Amazon do use DMT, and it is a sacrament, and that's why I stress, because it's all in how and why we use it. So in condensing down the book and the many varied and deep journalistic coverage of ayahuasca culture and the themes, and also basically the trip reports, and you know, there's 24 different curanderos in the book and 24 different trips, you know, but it's a seamless narrative that goes from the outer space context culturally into the inner space context, and really really takes people on deep journeys. To condense that down into the book, we had the footage, because Ron doesn't have the dogma of some tribes that don't have familiarity with DMT, so he was exploring at that time in 2006, and he no longer does so. I think he's just working with the plant materials now, the ayahuasca and you know, all the many different varied plant materials. But in 2006, when I first met him at the Amazonian Shaman Conference, he was working with a Western scientist who's just called in the film Dr. Wan. And Dr. Wan was from the University of Washington, and his speciality was QEEG, which was quantitative electroencephalography scans, which is a bit like MRI, but without the big tube you go in. But he put a skull cap on, and he'd wire the skull cap with gel and, you know, electrodes, and the skull cap would be connected with a bus cord to the computer, and the computer had software to read your brainwave states. And so Ron and Juan were teaming up in this synergy of science and shamanism, the archaic and the futuristic, and providing a space. And this is the thing, Ron was still holding space as a shaman and cleansing the area and holding space for people to go deeper, right? So it's still a very sacred shamanistic ceremony, but it was smokable 5-MeO-DMT. Now, 5-MeO-DMT is a denser experience than just normal NN-DMT or some of the other tryptamines. You can get to the same, I liken it to levels of the bardo, to use, you know, a more Eastern philosophy phrase. And this is McKenna's riff, that these realms are translinguistic and we need language for them. And it's not impossible to describe them, but we really need to polish and perfect our ability to languageize the egoless states of the inner realms of inner space. And that was my joy, actually, my joy and my privilege to do so in the book and in the film. So 5-MeO is traditionally likened to the white light tunnel experience, the near-death or the death experience, in that, from my personal experience, you know, DMT can take you to many different astral geographies. There may be a mapping of the DNA or some genetic memory, or you can go into different levels of hyperspace and of sort of alien language. There's a common thread of, you know, almost like in the Matrix, when all the code starts to tinkle down like rain. I've experienced that as golden language, and there's this language center, or this sort of primal sort of curtain of language that is a common level in DMT. There's the entities, there's geometric, there's insectoid, there's many different levels of entities. You know, there's many, many different levels on normal DMT. All of those feel like the beach. And then 5-MeO-DMT is deep into the ocean, right?
Wow.
And it's very true. And it's not any, you know, type of macho type of ego aggrandizement here. It's just basically trying to communicate to you what the terrain is. It's the traditional classic archetypal white light tunnel. My linguistic shorthand for it was that it's more like a Super Hadron Collider of hyperspace. And my experience of what it was, opposed to the levels of the beach, you go deeper in, so you're not encountering any of the entities or any of those lower levels. You're going about, let's just say, 20 levels in. And when you go in that deep, you're going into a giant, organic, white light, womb-like space. But it is a tunnel. It's definitely a tunnel, and there's a roundness to it. And, you know, I could perceive, because I went in after having done a dozen or so ayahuasca journeys and was very vibrationally clean. I did the meditation going in. They had an eye mask on me, and we did a 10-minute alpha meditation to bring my brainwaves down while they were measuring it. And I had no resistance. I was fully being. I was present, you know, in a meditative sense, to then go into the experience without resistance. And that was really important, because I've talked to other people. We had Hamilton Morris, who's the drug columnist for Vice magazine, on our New York panel last week, the Sell Out New York show, and I was talking to him and asking him about his 5-MeO-DMT experience, and he said, you know, terrifying, terrifying.
Yeah.
Awfully, awful, you know, in the archaic sense of the word, full of awe.
Yeah.
You know, like you'd say awesome these days, but terrifying because of the emotional quality. It's like I call it the Super Hadron Collider, because on a vibrational level, what I was experiencing, this pure presence, was that I was merging, I was the drop rejoining the ocean, to use another, you know, analogy. In just, that's the most anchored term I can give to it, but in that white womb-like godhead of oceanic vibration, it was basically my vibrational wavefront, my consciousness, and my whole being as a vibrational signature was being opened and disassembled and read like a laser in a CD drive, right, or a DVD drive. And it felt like that whole tunnel was like the drive reading my vibrational wavefront and revealing, and I was hurtling into it, like sort of slow motion hurtling into it, and just bungee jumping into the Godhead, like astronauts when you see them floating along in space,
yeah,
but in inner space into this white tunnel. And the blessing was that the only thing that remained of my consciousness was the journalistic left brain bit, which was just witnessing and deconstructing, like thinking, like taking it in, having no other thoughts but what the experience was, and sort of sorting it and putting language to it.
Yeah, or trying.
So, well, there was no trying, because it was this relentlessness of being. So all I could do was be in the moment and get it. And because I was open to it, I didn't have resistance, and I emotionally, intuitively got it. And I got that it was basically God, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or whatever label you want to give it.
Right.
I like the Sufi term, the Godhead, which is slightly different from God as the source.
And has less baggage for us.
Has less baggage. And look, call it the Super Hadron Collider of hyperspace, you know, if you like, whatever. If you've been there, you'll know, right? But I was also witnessing around the circumference of the tunnel very, very slight fluctuations of the white. It was like in a snowstorm, there was like very light blues and yellows, but very, very slight energy fluctuations that were basically alive. They were basically like sub-program routines of the deeper Godhead. Could call them angels, I guess, like some type of entity sort of levels. And they were reading me, and, you know, trying to, not too much communication, but my whole wavefront was cascading off me, and it was like they were reading my memories, and I was being read. I was being read by the Godhead, like a CD, like a, mm-hmm, you know, like a drive.
Yeah, it's completely open.
And as I opened to it, the more I opened, the more it filled me. But it didn't just fill me from outside, it revealed that it was me all along. And it's a very important distinction, because in that moment, there was this total samadhi recognition that I was it and it was me. As I was hurtling into it, as I was bungee jumping into ego dissolvingness and deconstructing the situation around me. So it is actually, you know, my most sacred experience, and I offer it up. I offer it up and back to the tribe. It is in the film. We were very blessed at that time. My media companions, John Bowman and Vance Gallet, the photographer and the audio guy, we recorded it. They recorded we call it the experiment at La Rosa Cita. That's the name of Ron's lodge. And because it's unique. It's unique of this science and shamanism, this brainwave experiment. And we had the outside footage. And when you see the film, it is nothing like it has been done in Western cinema before or since. Like, it's quite unique in the response of what happens to my body. Because I realized towards the end of the experience, as I made a little groan sound, and stuff happened with my vibrations. I went into this, like, what do you call it, that thing when you, like, really, you know, the body locked in.
Like rigor mortis?
Like rigor mortis, but not dead, you know.
But not dead.
It was like this, the body went into like this
yeah,
the position.
Yeah.
And then waves of energy were coming through, and I'd make these little sounds. And the sound started to go into this glossolalia-like thing. And basically vibration started pouring through me. And as I was making sound, it created a feedback loop.
Right.
I won't tell you what happens, you have to watch it in the film, but it is the most intense psychedelic moment yet in Western cinema. And so what we did, we had this footage, so we recreated and we did the visuals to the most beautiful degree. Tim Parrish, the director and the video editor, has used some amazing visuals and very organic kaleidoscope type routines and things. So it's not just a Western eye candy, there's an emotional journey, and we take you on this journey. We take you on this journey. It's a spiritual journey, and I'm very raw, and but I'm very proud and pleased and blessed to be able to share that with audiences.
Well, that's very good of you to share that with us. I'm super excited to see it in film.
Yeah.
your most intimate spiritual moment, captured on film.
My friend the Tea Fairy, calls it, you know, the world's most, you know, full on entheo porn. It's a very intimate moment, you know.
Yeah.
It's me and God and you and the audience.
Yeah. That's nuts. Well, I'm excited to see it. Okay, well, after that, I wanted to ask you about the music of the film. I noticed that Aya Awakenings features traditional Ikaros, but also music by modern psychedelic artists like Spongle and Tipper, two of my favorites, by the way. Mm. So how did you decide on the spectrum? And do the two approaches to music, the new electronic stuff versus the traditional acoustic ceremonial, represent a deeper schism in approaches to these drugs?
Well, I don't think it's a schism. I think it's a mashup, you know. And this is the thing that basically we really wanted to anchor the indigenous spirituality in the film. We have Ikaros from Guillermo Arevalo, from Norma Panduro. We have some Western Ikaros from Kevin Furness. We've got Percy Garcia singing in there, and they're totally reverent and totally needed to communicate the sanctity of those spaces. But the overarching narrative of the movie is really also talking about not just indigenous culture but Westerners and why we're drawn to the ayahuasca culture, to the jungles of Peru, and to the invisible landscape of these spaces. And so especially with the DMT sequence, we wanted to have something which was more representative of Western culture and of that type of feel. And it was, you know, I'll credit both Tim Parrish and Lulu Medill, who's Tim's partner and is an amazing sound engineer herself and sound designer, and makes music under the name of Siren. And she's really storming Australia and the world at the moment with her beautiful, hypnotic, lush oral soundscapes and songs. But she's done an amazing job to integrate in the spoken word narration, which I've taken from the book, indigenous Ikaros, as we just mentioned, the jungle soundscapes, the insects, the frogs, the monkeys, the subtle things, and some of the computer program she used. You know, you see the workstation thing, and she's got like 20, 30 levels of audio really delicately blended in. And so what I believe happens is that there's this synesthesia that happens in the film, where because of the narration taking on the emotional left brain journey and the soundscapes and the visuals, it basically hits all the right spots of our sensory modalities, and it triggers basically a shamanic reaction. So people and the soundscapes are so valuable and so important to that. So, you know, part away along the process, we wrote to Spongle, and we received, eventually, it was hard to get through to them, but we did get permission to use the very famous the DMT track that's in there. This is a very sort of subtle background music as it builds to the DMT sequence. And Dave Tipper is a friend of ours and allowed us to use his music from Broken Soul Jamboree, one of the tracks from that, which is beautiful Western music there, which is used towards the end. We've also got Darpan, one of Australia's premier shamanic practitioners, who has a beautiful peace invocation right at the end. And I believe that, you know, it blends very, very well, very, very well with the music.
And continuing from that, can we reconcile the traditional ceremonial entheogenic experiences with recreational psychedelic culture? In other words, what lies between traditional ayahuasca or the traditional 5-MeO DMT ceremony and the rave scene?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because, you know, I'd throw a curveball in there and then say, what is recreational drugs, you know? And, you know, most people who you know, fulfill that sentence, we might be thinking of more somatic type of drugs, like, you know, even marijuana, alcohol, cocaine, things which are affecting the body. But the psychedelics per se, yes, they can be fun, and yes, they can be done recreationally, and I'm not against that. I think that the difference with ayahuasca and with proper use of DMT is that these are substances which take you to very deep places, and that you can... It's all about your intent. It's all about your intent. So, you know, as I stress in the film, they're both sacraments, which means they're sacred, and they should be approached in a sacred way. To balance that out, though, there's nothing wrong with recreation, because ecstasis, you know, in Greek, means ecstasy, basically means, you know, a higher connection to the divine. Ecstasis means this connection to the divine. And it's only, you know, work-based dominated cultures which have a problem with ecstasy in the original terminology, with this ability to relieve the pain of the body from the everyday baseline 9-to-5 and to experience higher dimensionality or energy. It's really only been our culture which denudes our palate of choices energetically to baseline or to coffee or alcohol or to things which reinforce the system. So recreation is fine, and I believe there's a spiritual component to that. I'm not saying do DMT recreationally because it's too full on. Of course, LSD has been used recreationally to fun degrees, but that was it's a very spiritual tool as well. If you look at the 60s, the big thing here is we are still developing a framework in 21st century entheogenic and psychedelic culture for initiation and for elder guidance. And we do have elders now in our culture, you know, who have lived through the 60s. They had to invent it from scratch. Mm-hmm. And so this whole idea of escapism or recreation, that was basically, I think, a whitewash, because it was a political threat to the establishment, because the LSD revolution was a revolution of consciousness. And so we've been left with this legacy of these things only being used as recreation, because they don't want to give us any other linguistical framework to understand that all of these tools that open up different aspects of yourselves, A, are sacred, A, are magical, and can change your consciousness. And by changing your consciousness, you change your vibration and you change your isms. You know, you become a different person. And so all of these can be used for healing modalities. Ultimately, even things made in a lab are part of nature. Nature has made us. We're all embedded within a natural matrix. It's just how much the morphic frequencies of some of these more newer rec chems are clean and are empty without the deep intergenerational relationships we have with the plants. But I would say that we do have an intergenerational relationship with LSD after all this time. Mm-hmm. And is a very accessible sacrament if you use sacramentally. So what's happening really with the entheogenic, which the language of that, we're having Dr. Carl Ruck here at the panel here in Boston tonight, and he was one of the coiners of the term entheogen in the 1980s to help, you know, along with Albert Hofmann and other people, to distance it from the political stigmatization of psychedelics. But psychedelics have sort of bounced back since then, and entheogens, which means, you know, invoking or revealing the divine within, is especially designed to give it that sacred framework. And it's sort of really, you know, coming down to, like, psychedelics or rec chems could be entheogens, technically, if it's invoking the divine within, if you're using it to reveal that you're more than you think you are. We all have this divine spark that, you know, mm-hmm. we can overlap with. But it traditionally, you know, it's used to describe the plants themselves, and nature secretes a multitude of psychoactive plants all across the planet, and they're designed specifically neurochemically to engage with sentient species. She's made them for a reason, and it's only because we have a dominated culture which fears the mother, which fears the planet, and has tried to extinguish our connection with the natural world, that we fear the mind-altering substances. They're all sacred, they're all made by the mother eventually, and I encourage people to find the others, to set up their little, you know, psychedelic or entheogenic support groups, and to work on these things. It's the work. You know, ayahuasca is often called the work because it's not recreation. You vomit, you purge, and you do a lot of psychic work on yourself. It's a modality which is challenging, and it is protected from the recreational sort of arena. But even within what we might consider recreational drug use, I believe that we have a need for people to step up and to be able to explore these dimensions as psychonauts or shamanauts, and to map the territory and to map the emotional terrain, and to bring back something of value. Because, you know, as McKenna said, if we're not bringing back the right ideas or the things of value, what good are our trips? You know, the planet is in this crossroads. We're at this tipping point where we can see all around us a financial collapse, an environmental collapse, a social collapse, because the old is making way for the new, and the new is going full circle with its archaic revival. And that's why the plant's coming back, to heal and to vibrationally reset. And so I really encourage people to take this seriously, you know, and recreation can be part of that.
Yeah you touched on a lot of things that I empathize with. Like, we don't really have a shamanic tradition.
we don't have a comfortable relationship with these plants that, you know, goes back centuries. And like you said, our forebears had to figure it out on their own from scratch, more or less. So if we're finally at the place where we do have some elders and we do have like a network of people who are sharing information, we are getting better at using them in a serious and spiritual way. But we're still far from what you'd call a framework where there's an actual initiation, where people are allowed and encouraged to explore themselves in this way.
This is the number one thing that tribal cultures, I mean, it's sort of artificial distinctions because, you know, I believe, you know, I've researched Albert Hofmann's backstory quite a lot, and there's some interesting things under the cover of the infamous Bicycle Day story, and basically it boils down to this. Albert Hofmann said in German, you know, the translation is he had a strange presentiment, and that's actually a bit of a diluted translation. In German, it's something like a Wogenholt, and it means basically, it's like in Greek they say that Eureka, it's that bolt from the blue. It basically, and this is all through scientific discovery and, you know, when ideas come in, it's almost because the time for that idea has come. And there's a larger, I call it a galactic ecosystem, but it's also, it's an inner space ecosystem. Like the galactic thing's not just in space, it's in the inner space as well. And when we're in the right orbit, it's like we're getting the right memetic clusters and right ideas are coming in. So we've come, we in the 1940s when he discovered LSD, and again, he synthesized the first 25 or more derivatives of, you know, LSD in 1938.
Yep.
And it wasn't until 1943, 5 years later, this meticulous chemist who never makes mistakes goes, wakes up one day, is like, oh my God, wait a sec, what was that 25th compound in that thing I did 5 years ago? Bullshit.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it doesn't make sense. And it's glossed over in psychedelic mythology. Either he's lying, which there is... I won't get into it now, but there is some historical framework there for the fact that there could have been reasons for him doing so in the, you know, middle of World War II and you know, 38 with the rise of the Nazis and lying low with the material.
Sure. Yeah.
Or B, he got a transmission from the blue that said, Albert, which he was a mystic. He admitted in his 100th birthday in Basel, Switzerland, 2006, he had mystical experiences in nature all the time, you know, when he was a youth. And so basically, he was a sensitive. So my theory is that nature wanted to connect the humans, which were spiraling out of control even at the, you know, turn of the early 20th century, with the post-industrialized era and what we were doing to the planet. Nature's alive and well. Nature's intelligent. Nature, we are her children. You know, she knows what she's doing, and she works on many different levels of being. So because we had at that time distanced ourselves from the garden, from the plants and Mother Nature, and we were in the cities, she needed to get through in the cities. So she looks at the circuit board, you know, the human circuit board. She finds a nice little inn with a mystic sensitive over there who's in the right spot, right place, right time.
Yeah.
Albert, look at that 25th, you know, combination. Boom. Mass market produced, you know, LSD, which was derived from natural ergo, you know, rye derivatives.
Yep.
And, you know, Albert synthesized liliquai, which is the morning glory seeds in the 50s,
yep,
and realized that there's only one molecule different from LSA to LSD.
Yep.
You know, and so, hello, it's like, you know, this is
he also ended
still
up
talking
being
about
the,
nature.
He ended up being the first person to isolate salvinorin A from salvia, too, I believe.
Yeah, right. So my theory is, you know, LSD basically, to use a sort of hippie shorthand,
mm-hmm,
it opened the mind in the 60s, a generation later ecstasy opened the heart in the 80s, and a generation later the power plants, the entheogens, and primarily ayahuasca is mm-hmm the vanguard amongst them, is connecting to spirit and the deeper dimensions. But we wouldn't be where we are now if we hadn't have gone through the previous psychedelic culture generations.
Right.
It's a wave after wave. It goes, you know, Kesey said the same thing, you know, on the beach in Mexico, is in electric Kool-Aid acid test. It's all waves. It comes wave after wave. It's all vibration. It's all wave. And it layers itself. So by going through these so-called man-made chemical steps, we've vibrationally adjusted enough to be open to the vibration of the plants, the sensitive vibration of the plants, enough of us, a critical mass of us, to then go back to the garden. But nature had to basically inoculate enough people to get the layering right to get back to the garden, to the plants.
Right. It's not like in the 60s everybody was going to go to Peru and do ayahuasca.
Exactly.
But now
exactly,
you see that's what's happening, spiritual tourism.
Yeah, and you know, Peru wouldn't have been able to cope with that influx. I mean, Maria Sabina's village was overwhelmed in the 70s, 60s and 70s by hippies trampling through Mesoamerica looking for the magic mushrooms.
Yeah, right.
But you know, what we've had, you know, well, basically 61 years of or more of, you know, since LSD was invented. Was it 71 years? A long time, anyway, since we've had these drugs, and we've had the 60s generation through the 80s generation through the, you know, the early 21st century now, we've had successive generations. So we do have elders that are out there. We do have practitioners in the medical field who are helping pioneer this reclamation of psychedelics into the medical fold because they worked with them back in the 60s.
Yep.
We've got legacy, we've got lineage, which is one of the key components of the ayahuasca Peruvian, you know, Amazonian tradition where people are going because there's an unbroken lineage. There is an awful lot of teething issues abounding with the business of spirituality in the Amazon. But still, we have a vibrant global shamanic culture now where we didn't before.
And we're at the crossroads. We're at a big turning point. And
we need it. This is the thing I was saying earlier. We need new ideas. We need fresh perspectives. We need to be able to feel what we're doing to the planet, because the reason we've trashed the planet is because we've been distanced from the feedback loop of understanding what it is and the relationship that we have with her. So if you know, ayahuasca and the entheogens can really help kickstart that emotional relationship with the planet and the web of life, then we're not going to trash the planet.
Right. I have just one more question. So you touched on how Terence McKenna had given advice that we should bring back as much as possible.
You know what he said? He said, we don't want the big ideas that are so big that they're too impossible to implement, and we don't want the small ideas like your finger would perfectly fit in your nostril. We want the middle-sized ideas like the fish. You go hunting for the fish that are going to feed you tonight. You know, they're going to be useful.
Yep.
We want to bring back something from these experiences, and there's many things. Look at biomimicry, look at the way the networks are developing and the internet and communications models. And we were talking earlier before this interview about, perhaps psychedelics could be a cultural lubricant for augmented reality and virtual reality and the ability of everyone processing so much data on their phones and on computers and this distributed consciousness of, everyone always on in feeds at all one time. What's it doing to us? Well, here's the thing. Psychedelics are ego-dissolving. There's got to be something in that minefield that can help with this integration of the technology, which is also, I believe, one step before this digital telepathy. It's getting us back to the natural networks and the natural non-linear distributed consciousness sort of frequencies.
Yeah. So supposing he's right, and that's what we should do, is take as much back as we can. Given that some of the experiences are ineffable or translinguistic, how are we supposed to do that?
Well, they're not. And this is the important thing. People who said that, including McKenna, you know, he basically said that back in 71 at the experiment at La Chorrera in Invisible Landscape. We've had a whole generation and a half of trippers and of trip reports and of dissemination of these spaces to draw upon. And the culture back then, when he coined the term translinguistic, I think McKenna coined, him and Dennis coined the term translinguistic, that's where I first remember seeing it in one of his books. But they were sci-fi mutant beatniks from the 50s, right? But they were drawing upon the language of their culture at that time. And they coined the term in the 70s or in 75, at least, when that book first came out. We now have a culture which can understand not just the really old school things like upload, download. We can understand mesh networks. We can understand parallel processing. You know, we can understand cloud computing. All of those are getting very close to how nature herself works with consciousness in the species. So we have an enhanced vocabulary already to describe those paradigms and those systems, and to metaphor and bundle that to the entheogenic experience. So I believe that time has never been better to languageize the translinguistic experience. And please, as well as watching the film, I do encourage people to get the book Ayah Awakenings. It's on Amazon.com or ayahthebook.com, because in that book, I really anchored so many translinguistic experiences. It became secondhand. It was intimate each time, and each time was fresh, and each time was sacred. But what I realized, here's the thing, in the really deep ego-dissolving experiences, you can't describe it, right? Like this, you know, say the 5-MeO presence of the Godhead. But what you can do is you can linguistically sculpt around it, and you can build up a framework of semantic meaning by using metaphors and similes and like and as. And what happens is you cluster towards an emotional truth without being able to name the thing itself. Because language does fall off the translinguistic like water, you know, it flows around it, but you can still carve out a channel.
Yeah, you can.
And I really encourage people to find the words, and there's a, you can sculpt with words, you can sculpt an object, or can sculpt the experience, and you can communicate the truth of the experience, even though the experience itself is beyond words.
Right.
It is doable, and it's really good question you asked, and I totally encourage people to do this, because the more trip reports we have, what I believe we're doing is we're mapping the invisible landscape, the terra incognita. We're mapping it with words, and as we know with our technologies at the moment, these words are probably the first step to being able to have, you know, like that brain modeling software, and you can three-dimensionally map ideas.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really seeing a very near point in the future where we have sites like DMT Nexus, where they do their synchronized DMT journeying into inner space, and they bring back, they've got a hyperspatial lexicon, and they're working as a group to map and to agree upon the language and signposts of the dimensionality of the language, and to build up, you know, a map of this terrain. And I think that we could do this as a generation of shamanauts. It's the number one thing we can do is, we can't always bring back the experience, but we can bring back language about the experience. We can agree upon these hyperspatial signposts, and we can start to share the maps, because there be dragons on the fringes, and this is what happened, you know, this is what we've done in history. There's an element and a danger of, you know, cultural imperialism, and once you have the maps, you know, give it a generation, you'll have the McDonald's of hyperspace. But, you know, I think that we have to do it, and we have to do it with integrity and with the right approach as well.
Yeah. And I think these states and consciousness in general can't be understood completely, no matter how much mapping we do. But I think the closer we get and the more we understand about it, the less scary it is. Because if it's a complete unknown, you know, our nature is to fear the unknown. That's our old survival instinct. And so when we know a little bit more about it, you know, I've read a lot of trip reports. This is what people tend to experience. I'm not guaranteed to have that experience, but this is what that landscape is like. And this is what the LSD headspace is like. Once you know a little bit about it, you sort of get your feet wet a little bit. It becomes a lot less scary. And when it's less scary, you're much better, much more likely to have healthy, beneficial, therapeutic trips and experiences.
Totally. And also you can prepare more for it. My favorite analogy to this is basically deep sea diving. And when there's a certain level where you can go on the top of the water, you can go just under the water,
yep.
you can scuba dive, you can deep scuba dive if you've got the air tanks. And if you've got the tanks filled with nitrogen, you can, you know, adjust what you're intaking, and you can go miles down into deep sea crevices where no human has ever explored before.
Mm-hmm.
That's basically what we're doing. So by sharing the signposts and the maps, we can prepare in advance. You know, like I have had this a rare experiment many years ago now where we did injectable ketamine and injectable DMT, you know, as a bundle, and the ketamine helps slow down and relax into the DMT experience. So by knowing where you're going and by preparing in advance, I think we can be more professional with this, and we can go deeper and get more things of value to bring back.
Yeah, and the first step, I think we can agree, is to treat them as tools like they are and not as poisons.
Yeah, and the other thing to really remember as well is that when you do go into these realms, you may meet the natives, you know. And the thing is, again, you know, A, don't believe everything, and B, be careful, because, you know, there's just like if you go swimming in the deep ocean, you might encounter some fish, you might encounter a shark, you might, you know, it's like people who don't believe that these entities exist in hyperspace independent of our psychological subconscious don't value the fact that there's dangers as well as benefits in these realms. And I do believe that there are independent entities, and I believe that we have to go prepared, and we have to armor ourselves up and know a bit of, you know, talking about meditation before, and meditation is good, and also perhaps a bit of magical sort of framework and ability, like banishing rituals or, you know, things, because it's all vibration in there. It's all your thought, and your thought creates your reality and magnetizes other vibrational entities to you.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to be able to be warriors of the mind, be spiritual warriors to then defend ourselves. And this is what the shamans of the Amazon do, is they have allies, they have spirit allies, the jaguar and other entities are often used to protect themselves or to attack on the astral planes. And I liken it to Jung and his analogy of the, you know, the subconscious and the collective unconscious, and then there's a deeper realm of the canvas which these consciousness frequencies are on, like as neural output. And I believe that there's, the tryptamines connect us to the realm where many species who have tryptamines in them overlap. So we see insect entities a lot because they have DMT as well. And so a lot of the other plants and a lot of the other creatures who may share a consensual interspecies unconscious, collectively in these realms. And so we don't know enough. And when we don't know, we need to go in with wisdom and go in prepared and go in still with an open heart, but with a guarded sort of mind, I guess.
Yeah, and even if it turned out these entities were only existing in the subconscious, that doesn't mean that they don't pose a danger.
Exactly.
Because they're so
exactly,
real, yeah. These entities, that when you experience them, they're so real that it doesn't matter if your sober self regards them as fictions entirely.
They still affect you.
Yeah.
And then, there can be psychological damage as well. So there are pros and cons, and people have to treat this, with the right respect and the right integrity.
Yeah. We do well to tread cautiously.
Yeah.
All right. Well, what a way to finish. Thank you so much, Rapper Zam. Good luck on your new film. Everybody listening, do go and see it. There's a U.S. tour going on right now with, I think, five locations in California?
Ten cities around the U.S. If you just go to aya-awakenings.com, you can see the U.S. tour dates there, and you can watch the film on video on demand if you can't make one of the events. We do like to treat the events as a medicine night itself. We have smudgings as people come in, the movies, the medicine, and then we have some sharing circles with panelists and guest talking about all these other things, so it makes it a full night of it. And you can also, check out the book. It's on that website as well.
Very good. Well, thanks again, Rax. It's been good talking to you. This is Psychedelic Frontier signing off.